So I mentioned last week that we're going to start like a series of talks on every Sunday, the core teachings of the Buddha, which are oftentimes referred to as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And so tonight we're going to talk on the topic of dukkha. Sometimes this is referred to as the First Noble Truth, or the First Noble Task. Last week we framed up and maybe asked this question of why would we, be interested in having a meditation practice and coming to a Buddhist and an intentional community and practicing the teachings of the Buddha together. And we reflected a little bit on the story of the Buddha, that maybe perhaps some mythological or, but telling really of the Buddha's intention for awakening, and maybe some of the ways that we would frame up and talk about and discuss what is awakening, and is that something that we are interested in? Is that something that we relate to? Is that something that resonates with us? And so what are we waking up to is kind of the question. And as a pragmatist, as a practical teacher, the Buddha was interested really in this question of what types of practices can I undertake to find more ease, more well-being. And I think of his teaching that he offered to us as, and I often make this analogy, is like a map, and it's oftentimes referred to as the Dharma, which is the teaching of the Buddha, the Dharma map. And it's a reference point, it's a landscape, it's a series of markers and terrain to be interested in. So we can look into our lives, so we can look into the conditions of our lives, to look at this truth of dukkha. Part of the etymology or some of the discussion around what dukkha is mostly it's a word that's very hard to translate. It comes from the Pali Sanskrit, kind of a breakdown of two words, which means du and akash. What we're waking up to, what we're starting to be curious in and interested in, is this part of our experience that tends to be bumpy, that tends to have some friction, some stress, maybe is a way to define dukkha. Some dis-ease, some unsatisfactoriness. I like to think that really what we're hoping to wake up to is our vulnerability, is the reality and the connection with this reality that we're vulnerable, that life in and of itself is not secure, it's not stationary, it's not stable, it's dynamic, it's transient, it's unpredictable, it's uncertain. And that the dukkha, the rub, the vulnerability of this experience is that we're born into a body that gets older and that doesn't quite function in the ways that we want it to, and that doesn't quite age in the ways that we want it to. And that finds itself afflicted with ailments and conditions and disorders and diseases. that one thing that we are certain of, as soon as we develop some abstract thought and maybe enough social normalcy around, is the certainty of death. That our time, this idea of time and the constraint and the construct of time, is something that we, in a sense, create to be able to live in the world and to plan and to prepare, but for what end? And what is it, that all of this time that we're spending and doing? And, you know, so this is kind of that really subtle dynamic, a part of that subtle dynamic of what the Buddha was waking up to, is what really am I doing here? Am I alive or am I living? You know, am I attuned to the certainty of this vulnerability, of this change? And so in one sense, there's the dukkha-dukkha, that's what it's called. There's the certainty of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And there's the inherent vulnerability of that reality. And you could even say the stress, or the kind of existential shock of that. And most of the time, you know, for most of us, myself included, it's not so much something on a daily basis that, you know, maybe more so now in my life, but, you know, ordinarily it's not so much something on a daily basis that I'm as tuned into, right? It's kind of like that feeling when you get sick, and then you get sick and you're grateful all of a sudden for all the times. You're like, man, I just wish my fucking nose would work, right? Or I just wish that, you know, and then the sickness kind of lifts and it's like you feel 10 times better than you did before you were sick. Right? We don't really kind of consider that or reflect on that maybe as often. So there's the dukkha-dukkha. There's just the rub of existing. The friction of existing. Du-akash, that etymology of that word, what it more directly is translated into is... it's an image of like an ox cart, and where the axle of the cart doesn't quite fit. It's disjointed from the center of the wheel well. And so 90% of the ride around this big ox cart wheel is pretty smooth. You know, it's in joint, it's together, and then you hit the little bump. Right, and then it's not that bad because you got, you know, a couple seconds of smooth and then you hit the bump. Right, and that this life, you know, this life experience has that bumpiness, it has that disjointedness. There's also, from the most immediate and probably the most mutually understandable versions of this dukkha that we're waking up to is the dukkha of our social strata, of the bigger picture. Another way to describe or break down this word is an innate sense of feeling separate from the other. So this disjointedness where something doesn't quite connect, another way to look at that is where there's kind of this feeling, this innate feeling that something is wrong, something about me is disconnected, it doesn't fit. I don't have a place, so what do I do out of that vulnerability of not having a place? We go and we look for our place. And we look around and we scan and we find people that look like us and we find people that we think believe the same things or value the same things, and we find a way to be a part of, and we find a way to feel human connection that is really challenging, that's really disappointing and really awkward and really uncomfortable. And so we all, this separateness, this feeling, you know, of maybe not being liked or maybe not quite fitting in, It baffles me how much all of us, you know, I spend my week with people and doing therapeutic work and spend my time with hundreds of people a week where we all share this insecurity of being, this separateness. You know, we share this, but we don't share it. We don't oftentimes, you know, have a way or a means of really feeling safe enough or comfortable enough to maybe start to look at that feeling of separateness. And so this is where in the later schools of Buddhism, and especially in the Mahayana schools, the focus and emphasis becomes a lot of times on the mutuality of awakening. So awakening to this bigger dukkha of this separateness, that actually my own suffering of birth, aging, sickness, and death, it's shared. It's a shared burden. It's a shared vulnerability. And so we don't wake up alone. We wake up in sangha and community, in intentional communities. And my sense is that any communities, family systems, supportive communities where we feel like we can express our fears, our anxieties, our dukkhas, right, our insecurities, that really eases a lot of that suffering. And then there's this dukkha of mental anguish, Sankhara dukkha, this dukkha of the neurotic and incessant preparing and planning and perfecting and comparing and compartmentalizing and judging and, right, the endless, restless, neurotic mind and heart, for that matter, the emotional anxieties, the emotional afflictions. And there's the dukkha of change, of, again, this is more of the bigger picture, that nothing is static, of loss, of being separated from what's dear to us, what's close to us. I want to read a quote by one of the Thai forest masters of this tradition, the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, named Ajahn Chah, really of this lineage of Against the Stream. He said that people have suffered in one place, so they go somewhere else. When they have suffered there, they run off again. They think they are running away from suffering, but they are not. It goes with them. They carry suffering around without knowing it. If we don't know suffering, then we can't know the cause of suffering. If we don't know the cause of suffering, then we can't know its release. So why would we wake up to this? Why would we be interested and curious in this? You know, and so I think that it's a good question. And I want to... I figure Eloise and I can share both a little bit and maybe have a little conversation together as well. So I'll just stop there for now.
Yeah, and then a conversation with everybody. I guess one of the ways I think about it is, why would you meditate? You know, why would you do any of this? Why are you here right now? Why do you invest your time in this way? What are you hoping to get from it, or what are you looking for? And I think for me, for most of us, there's some sense of, I want to feel okay. I just want to feel okay, or I want to feel better. I want to feel happy, I want to have meaning, I want to heal from some experiences that are the types of experiences that one would have to heal from, you know, when those happen. And I think what was said in the Ajahn Chah quote, that if we want to be free from our suffering, we have to know suffering. And I think that's one of the things where Buddhist thought or the Buddhist perspective kind of diverges from, I feel like, a lot of what I was taught when I was a kid, or what I see in the culture around me, which is, A lot of it's a denial or a disowning of suffering and pain and difficulty. I don't want suffering and pain and difficulty, so I'm going to get away from suffering and pain and difficulty. I'm going to minimize it. I'm going to not pay attention to it. I'm going to definitely not show it to other people. If I don't pay attention to it, it won't be there. That kind of strategy. And it'd be really cool if that worked, right? If I could just, like, not, you know, have to go there. And it hasn't been my experience that it works very well. And I think it's because of what was said in the Atsan Cha quote, is if we want to get rid of, if we want to have some freedom from suffering, we actually need to understand the how it comes to being. How am I suffering about my experience? What are the conditions that bring the suffering about? And that's going to involve a little bit of a willingness to hang out with it, to check it out, to experience. So kind of counterintuitively, maybe to free up from our suffering a little bit, we're going to have to be find some sense of willingness to turn towards and embrace some of the places that can be a little bit uncomfortable or difficult to sit in. I think it's important to note, I believe that through Buddhist practice we can tap into a complete and absolute freedom from suffering. So complete freedom, separate from the conditions of our lives, whatever's going on in the conditions, I think we can be free. But I don't think a complete freedom from pain is on offer. I don't think a complete freedom from sadness is on offer. I don't think it's coming. So sorry.
That's why we don't charge for it.
Yeah. It's just not going to be part of the thing, I think. And it's in the way that the Buddha describes dukkha, he says birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, and death is dukkha. Being greeted with what you don't want or what is not dear is dukkha, and being parted with what you do want is dukkha. And part of the idea is that that's actually a non-negotiable part of the human experience. You can't get out of being born, the ship sailed on that. Can't get out of illness, can't get out of aging, and can't get out of dying. And you can't get out of having conditions not meet your preference. You're just going to be in situations and in moments where your emotional experience is not what you'd want it to be right now, your body doesn't feel the way you'd want it to, you go in thinking things are going to be one way, and then they end up being another way. I stained my new pants today. I don't know how. It just happens, you know? And when I first came into this practice, this is one of the first things I heard, and I experienced it as being just a tremendous relief to hear from someone else to say, have you noticed that you keep trying to just get everything to line up the way you want it to be, and then you just, it just doesn't quite work out the way you want it to, or even when you get it all just right, it's impermanent. So even when you have that great moment of just like you're at home, everything's just right, you're warm and comfortable, and it's just all good. And then it hits 11 p.m. and you're like, oh, I have to go to work tomorrow. So it ends and you go into the bathroom and you just cleaned the bathroom 6 days ago, but there's already dust starting in the corner and you're just like, I just dealt with you and I don't want to deal with it again. So this is the dukkha of life and it's non-negotiable. So I just experienced it as a real relief that it's not, I had a sense that it was my fault and that maybe other people had figured out a better way and were somehow, were more together than me or just didn't have, I feel like it was my fault. And I think a lot of the suffering in our life, it's not actually our fault, but it is our responsibility to heal from it. No one else can do it for us. And it's our responsibility to heal our own suffering so that we can have a better quality of life and so that we don't have to hurt ourselves or hurt the people around us in some of the ways that we can become habituated into. And I came to Buddhist practice because I've had some trauma in my life. I've had some addiction in my life. I had some difficult experiences. I'm queer, I'm gender nonconforming, And there's been some dicey moments in the entire experience. And that's really all I have to say. I think that you can be... I believe in the human capacity for change. That's what we talk about in Refuge. It says we understand it from human experience. And if we can, you can, and we have, so you will too. And a better way to say it would be we still are. It's still a process. We're figuring it out. We're figuring it out together.
Yeah, one of the analogies that I've heard describing the practice, you know, like how we ordinarily live our lives, and then the practice of mindfulness and waking up to, right? So mindfulness is the direct path to awakening. And so through mindfulness practice, we actually start to become more intimate with the ways in which we experience dukkha. And so whereas, you know, in our kind of public venue, we sometimes put this nice pretty bow on mindfulness, like we're really waking up to this blissed out, easeful, peaceful, white linens, you know, everything's clean and healthy. But really, we're waking up to the patterning and the neuroses and the conditioning and the traumas and the dissatisfaction. And why do we do that? Not because it's necessarily good news. Right, you know, the Bible salesman, have you heard the good news? It's like, have you heard the bad news? But it's good, it's great information. It's great information. And so I've heard this path kind of being described like you're in an airplane and you make a decision, okay, I'm going to go skydiving or whatever. You just wake up like in a bad dream and you realize you're falling. Right? And you're falling and you're falling and you're falling and you go to pull your chute and there's no chute, right? And there's no chute, and so it's kind of this shock or this trauma of waking up to this reality of the stress or the falling, that feeling of being out of control and uncertain. And then so what do? Well, we look for something. Is there an ocean nearby? You know, we go to try to grab, you know, take the shirt off and try to make an umbrella. We do all of the things that we can, or a parachute or whatever. You can do all the things. Umbrella wouldn't really help that much. But, you know, we try to reach and grab and find some ground. And then the Dharma, the refuge of the Dharma, is realizing there's no ground. You're just falling. You know, you're just falling, and we're all falling. And they sometimes call this the groundless ground. And so what's more real, really, than reality? You know, what's really more, and then how do we live when we're attuned and we're in touch, when we're with mindfulness framed up and connected to that? If I really actually knew how certain my death is, you know, would I live differently? You know, would I live with more presence? Would I be more attentive when my mom's on the phone, right? If I knew how certain that this loss is. So dukkha, in a weird way, it's both the maybe bad news, but it's also the good information of how to then live with an intention and an awakened heart. So that's the awakening, this very simple, ordinary awakening. What are we waking up to? This. That's it. There's no magic moment. Maybe there is. You know, I probably won't find that, right? Maybe some monk somewhere with the dedication and the practice and the building of momentum. I actually don't want to discount that. Right? Maybe there's a more intense version of awakening. But I really think the general sense is we're waking up to a way to be in our life in a way that we can find less suffering collectively, we can find more presence, more intention. Did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Just really quickly, it might come out in the questions or the discussion we'll have, but just some strategies or just some thoughts on how to work with it or what to do. You know, you notice you got some dukkha in your life. Does anyone notice that they have some difficulty in their lives? Okay, cool. I still do, and I always, sometimes I'm in rooms of strangers facilitating. I'm not now, I know a lot of people in the room, but I'll just really want to, like, try to elicit someone to share about something difficult in their lives if I don't know everyone, because I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I'm in a room with humans, you're like me, we're all good. Because I'll just imagine that everyone has their shit together sometimes, and thankfully no one really does, so it's a great relief. But, you know, what do you do about the dukkha in your life? And it might have already been said, but I just think a big, really important part is just finding a little bit of an attitude of letting yourself off the hook, not separating or feeling alone because you still have some difficulty. It's really it's really easy to imagine possible, ideal, better future versions of ourself that we feel like we should be and think, I really should be this other way. This better way. And when I'm that's when I can really come and connect and show up, and that's when I'll have friends, and that's when I'll, you know, open up. But I'm not there yet, so tonight I just have to stay small, I have to disconnect, I have to, you know. And finding a way to start to push through some of that, and that's the vulnerability thing, which can actually maybe be your greatest asset, because if you're willing to, there can be like the I'll show you mine if you show me yours thing. So it's like if you show other people some of your, you know, what's really going on, maybe they'll show you too, and then you can really start to connect. And also becoming really clear about what's the unavoidable just friction of being alive, and then what's unnecessary suffering that we're creating for ourselves. And that's what we're going to, as Andrew continues with the series on the Noble Truths and kind of keeps talking about the second truth of craving and aversion and looking at the ways we create unnecessary suffering, it's important to be clear. Because some of the harm we're causing to ourselves, the difficulty we're experiencing, the harm we're causing to other people, it's not necessary. It might be motivated out of a lack of wisdom, a lack of clear seeing, habits we picked up in the society and our family system that made sense there that just aren't really helping us anymore. And then we can start to work on how to abandon some of the ways we cause suffering for ourselves and to cultivate new strategies, new skills.